from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Mass shootings at two mosques in Christchurch rocked New Zealanders to their core. What may have shocked Americans even more is the response of New Zealand's government. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern quickly and emphatically declared that she would not say the name of the shooter.
He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless.
And most media outlets have followed suit. It's a stark contrast to the way mass shootings are covered in this country, with shooters' names and stories prominent in the days immediately following a shooting. Does New Zealand's prime minister have science on her side? Jacqueline Schildkraut is associate professor of criminal justice at the State University of New York at Oswego. She's co-author of Mass Shootings, Media, Myths, and Realities, Mass Shootings in America, Understanding the Debates, Causes, and Responses, and now Columbine, 20 Years Later and Beyond, Lessons from Tragedy. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The biggest concern with media reporting the perpetrator's name is the possibility of sparking copycats. How strong is the evidence that that actually happens?
You know, the evidence is certainly compelling. It is a newer area of research, but the results have been consistent in terms of the studies that have been conducted, suggesting that there's actually both a short-term contagion effect and also a longer-term copycat effect, such that in the shorter term, we see that the likelihood of another shooting increases with the amount of media coverage within the first 12 to 14 days after a highly publicized attack.
Are there other implications of media coverage, other potential ramifications that we should be thinking about?
Oh, absolutely. There's sort of four big ones to think about. You know, first and foremost is that when these individuals conduct these acts in such a public manner, they are effectively doing it because they want fame and they want notoriety. And in basically covering them and covering them so heavily, they are basically being rewarded for killing other people. At the same time, especially in cases where there's a high level of media interest, you know, Christchurch in New Zealand is certainly a prominent example, but we can look as far back as Columbine. It's signaling to other, you know, like-minded individuals that if you want a lot of attention, then you can kill a lot of people and the media will reward you with an extensive amount of coverage. Also in that same sort of mindset, you know, the extensive media coverage can also, especially with something like with the Christchurch, where the perpetrator live streamed his killings, it's also providing a template for those other like-minded individuals. But I think the biggest thing that we have to think about is what does it do to the people who are impacted? And not just impacted about that specific shooting, but every time there's another shooting, it re-triggers communities that have been impacted. I'm actually out in Colorado right now, and from talking to people that I'm friends with out here, there's a lot of Columbine survivors that have been impacted by the New Zealand shooting and the amount of coverage it was receiving.
And what about the broader public, not those directly impacted by these shootings, but is there an impact in terms of attitudes towards these shootings, attitudes toward violent crime in general that changes with the media coverage of these events?
You know, it's hard to say if it's specifically the way in which the media cover it or more specifically the amount of which the media cover it. You know, there's certainly a desensitization element such that people don't really have the same outward visceral reactions. I think people still feel bad, right? They don't want to see other people being harmed. But I think, you know, the shock that we all felt 20 years ago watching Columbine unfold live on television isn't really there. I can remember last year when the YouTube shooting happened, the shooting at the YouTube headquarters happened, and I happened to be watching it actually on Facebook. And I remember seeing in the comments where somebody said, well, you know, it has been 3 weeks since we had a shooting, you know, we should have expected this. And I think, you know, the amount of coverage that these events receive certainly play into attitudes like that.
Jacqueline Schildkraut, in an article that you wrote for Vox after the Parkland shootings, you explicitly refused to name the perpetrator. You've even refused to be part of media coverage that names or shows footage of a mass shooting perpetrator. And there have been multiple campaigns by victims' families going back several years, by academic experts like yourself, even the FBI, to change the way that the American media covers mass shootings. Why hasn't it changed?
You know, I think there's a little bit of contention. You know, as I mentioned, the area of research is somewhat newer. I mean, when we look at, you know, the the time that this has been going on. And I think that there's sort of this concern over the requests that all of us are making is an infringement upon First Amendment rights. And even news consumers say, well, we have a right to know. And no one is denying them the information of, you know, what happened in the shooting, even who committed it. But, and, you know, when people want their name in lights and you're literally putting their actual name in lights, so to speak, you know, that's really where that reward component comes in. They want their name known. And so by denying them that and removing that incentive, that's what we're calling for. You can say the perpetrator. It's the same two words as somebody's first and last name. So you can still say the perpetrator walked into this building and did this. And you're giving everybody all of the information they normally would have gotten. You're just not rewarding the killer.
So what would, in your mind, based on the body of science that we do have at this point, what would media coverage done well look like?
You know, I think we did see some definite strides with Christchurch, especially with, of course, the New Zealand media. The No Notoriety campaign, which I actually work for, was started by Tom and Karen Teeves after their son Alex was murdered in the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. And, you know, the No Notoriety campaign, which is one of the most prominent campaigns in this area, you know, it's not calling for a complete blackout, which I think is also a misconception. It's calling for a limited use. If you have a situation like Parkland where the perpetrator walks out of the building and everybody needs to know who they are so that that individual can be captured and can't harm anybody, then absolutely plaster their face and their name everywhere. But once that person is apprehended, it should be limited. You know, talking about things like not giving prominent coverage, so not live breaking news where it's the first story, not, you know, front page coverage with their face really large, you know, kind of burying those stories in a sense to less prominent placement, not repeating their name over and over. We certainly understand you can't have a story about a shooter or a shooting without naming them once. But for instance, in New Zealand, one of the things that the judge did when the shooter came into the court for his initial appearance is the judge ordered that any photographs taken could be used only if the shooter's face was blurred out, which I thought was a very, you know, interesting idea. But then I was reading an article in one of our media sources here in the U.S., and while they utilized that photo, they then used his name 15 times. Mm-hmm. And so it's that kind of imbalance, I think, that's really problematic.
We have seen with this shooting in New Zealand much less of the perpetrator's name. Doing a Google search, I think I found one Australian outlet that actually put the name in a headline, and that was about it. And so obviously it is possible to cover an event without using the name copiously. But Jackie Schildkraut, you've done research showing that, in fact, these are changes that the American public would welcome.
Absolutely. We did a survey of a random sample of news consumers, and we found that, interestingly, when it comes to attitudes and perceptions about mass shootings and, you know, where they're formed, that the public really holds the media responsible. Of course, we know that there are, you know, obviously a growing number of people who are directly and even indirectly impacted by these events, myself included. But we also know that, you know, there's just so many other people who are, you know, getting this vicariously through the media. And, you know, that's the only source of information that they have is whatever gets put on television or social media. Of course, social media is a lot harder to control or, you know, regulate than newspapers or mainstream media because it's being conducted by a ton of different individuals. But not only do they hold the media responsible for those attitudes, but a lot of people, you know, more than 7 out of 10 people say, we'll still tune into this coverage, even if you don't gratuitously show the person's picture or say their name over and over again. And I think, you know, at this point, it's also a case of giving the people what they want, and it will still turn out beneficial for the media and also now for the public.
Of course, this case, as you just mentioned, has challenged some of that idea that the media can control all of this because the perpetrator in this case live streamed his actions on Facebook. It was viewed something like 4,000 times, I think Facebook has said, before they actually found it and took it down. I mean, there's a complex landscape to be navigated in terms of how this information is controlled or disseminated at this point.
Absolutely. And I can remember seeing an article in the first few days after the shooting where I think in the first 24 hours, Facebook intercepted about 1.5 million copies where people were trying to share or post, you know, that video. And, you know, if you think about it, what is really to gain, you know, in terms of sharing that video? There's not a lot of investigative value for the average citizen. And at the end of the day, you're watching people get slaughtered. You know, I understand that there's a, you know, sort of a morbid curiosity or an interest because we don't get to see them. But if we all take a step back and say, what are we really standing to gain out of that video being shared? The reality is that we're, again, giving notoriety to a person who walked into a church or a mosque and committed a very, very violent act.
Jacqueline Schildkraut, in addition to the fact that New Zealand's prime minister refused to say the name of the perpetrator, New Zealand's parliament, within a matter of days, had committed to a ban on assault rifles and possibly other changes to New Zealand's gun laws. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as much as we can talk about the role of the media and the responsibility of the media, I think we have to address also the role of gun access. How important is gun access versus, you know, information about these shootings and this possible copycat effect?
You know, I think if we're being honest, the reality is that if individuals are determined to carry out this type of attack, they're going to figure out a way to do this. And so it's not to suggest that we shouldn't have a conversation about firearms in this country. I would never be so brazen as to suggest that, but we've been having the same conversation for 20 years since Columbine, and nothing has happened. And I think if we look at Columbine as sort of this, you know, place where we can start trying to understand that conversation. You had two high school kids who at the time that they were able to acquire their weapons, they were both under the legal age to even have a weapon in their possession. So, you know, if you're talking about criminals, we know that criminals don't follow the law. So what other conversations can we be having? The reality is that, you know, mass shootings are very complex, multifaceted and multidimensional issues. And so to isolate, you know, the no notoriety side of it or to isolate the gun side of it is very short-sighted because you're missing out on so many other problems.
Jacqueline Schildkraut is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the State University of New York at Oswego and author of multiple books about mass shootings. Jacqueline, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, record flooding in the Midwest was a perfect storm made worse by climate change. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Nebraska is facing more than $1 billion in damage due to historic and devastating flooding this past week. The storm that set things into motion was powerful, a so-called bomb cyclone, but the amount of rain it delivered doesn't account for the flooding on its own. This past fall and winter were among the wettest on record for Nebraska, so that rain fell on frozen, waterlogged ground. And instead of soaking in, it ran straight into already full rivers. Some have called the result biblical, and anytime these kinds of superlatives come into play, one of the first questions that arises is this climate change? Joining me to answer that question is Kevin Trenberth. He's part of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and he's an expert on global warming's effect on storms and precipitation. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Big picture here. Is this an example of what we might expect with climate change, or is this a freak one-off?
Well, it's a bit of both. Climate change is certainly playing a role. On the other hand, there is all the weather events that go on, and there's a certain randomness to some of that. And at the moment, we also have an El Nino event. It's relatively modest out in the tropical Pacific, but that has played a key role in the overall storm tracks across North America for some time. And so one of the consequences of that is that it's wiped out the drought in California entirely for the first time for a long time. And the snowfalls in the Rockies have been at record high levels in March. And the snowpack is over 140% throughout the whole state of Colorado. So there's been, you know, record amounts of snowfall occurring before it gets to the Great Plains. But indeed, the winter as a whole, December, January, February, was the wettest on record for the United States. And this is exactly the sort of thing we do expect with climate change. And one of the reasons is because the air is a bit warmer. Therefore, it can hold more moisture. One of the consequences of that also is that some of what would have fallen as snow instead falls as rain. And this is one of the factors in some of the flooding. If it had fallen as snow, it would have sat there for a while and then gradually melted. And instead, if it falls as rain, suddenly it all can run downstream and accumulate. And so that exacerbates some of the flooding.
Well, Kevin Trenberth, let's talk about the bomb cyclone. I mean, your work focuses on the influence of climate change on storms and precipitation. This was an unusually powerful storm, even for a part of the country that is used to winter storms. We're talking about pressure readings comparable to a Category 2 hurricane, you know, wind speeds close to 100 miles an hour. As you just said, some of this we have to attribute just to weather. Extreme weather happens, big storms happen, but how much of the strength of this storm might be attributable to climate change?
It was very unusual for a storm to develop the way it did, where it did, because the Rockies themselves often sort of interfere with the development of that kind of a storm. And storms prefer to develop once they're free of the influence of the of these big mountains sticking up into the storm to disrupt the low-level flow that helps the storms get organized. But it just came across a part of the Rockies which didn't do that as much as it might otherwise have. And so there's a chance aspect related to that. Here in Boulder, we had, where I am, we certainly had blizzard conditions, but only for about 4 hours. And it was a lot worse in many other places, including out at the Denver airport. And boy, that those strong winds and the heavy, wet snow that was blasting everything and riming on things was certainly caused a lot of problems.
One of the problems was that this rain couldn't possibly sink in part because the ground was frozen. Temperatures this winter in the Midwest have been particularly cold, below average temperatures. And of course, anytime there are below average winter temperatures, we hear somebody piping up and saying, well, how can these below average temperatures possibly be consistent with climate change? So is there a climate change role in how cold the Midwest winter has been this year?
Well, you know, one of the things which is important in that regard is the snow cover. Normally, you would have a snow cover, and that actually keeps the ground warmer, surprisingly, perhaps. Mm. And in the absence of snow, the ground can indeed cool off and freeze more. And so this is a factor in the way in which, a weird way in which global warming can perversely affect things. But the overall coldness and the storm track, I would have to blame probably a bit more on the El Nino condition, which pushes the storm track across the middle of the country more instead of closer to the Canadian border. And as a result, if the storms are tracking across the middle of the country, they can reach out to the Gulf and pick up the moisture that's coming out of the tropical North Atlantic. There's tons of moisture there, and this bomb cyclone was a big storm, and it had a big outreach. And so the moisture that was flowing into the storm was coming from over 1,000 miles away. And there's also, in the early stages, a component coming from west of Mexico. And so by having the track of where this particular storm was, it has the outreach to pick up the moisture from over the oceans and feed that into the storm itself. And so it's the spatial extent of the storm and the fact that it was raining up over such a wide area that is also a factor.
Kevin Trenberth, you've mentioned El Nino a number of times, and I wonder, as someone who studies the link between climate change and, you know, extreme storms and precipitation, when you think about how climate change influences these weather patterns, is climate change changing El Nino, making it stronger, more frequent, something like that, or is climate change introducing completely new and different patterns or factors that influence storms on top of or in addition to El Nino?
Well, El Nino is a natural phenomenon. It's certainly been going on for many centuries, and we have records that suggest in even thousands of years. And there's a lot of natural variability that occurs with the El Nino phenomenon itself. The way in which climate change is clearly influencing the El Nino is through the consequences of the events that are associated with it. And so El Nino phenomenon and its sister, the La Nina, the other phase, are responsible for more of the patterns of droughts and wet areas, the floods around the world, especially throughout the tropics and subtropics. And so the main manifestation that the climate change brings to that is that those floods and droughts are more severe and longer lasting than they otherwise would be. And so in the dry spells, you end up with stronger heat waves and wildfires. And in the wet areas, the rainfall is greater and the risk of flooding is greater.
Obviously, this is a complicated situation in the Midwest, a number of different factors that we've been talking about that led to the historic flooding event. But if you think back to last fall, Hurricane Florence and the flooding in the Carolinas, even before that storm hit, we already had climate scientists saying, you know, we've run the models and the precipitation from this storm is likely to be 50% worse than it would be without climate change. They were already putting numbers to the influence of climate change before and as the storm was hitting. And I haven't really seen those kinds of numbers and that firm attribution of the role of climate change in this event yet. Obviously, the event is still playing out, but I wonder if you have any insights as to why. Is it because it's a more complex event? Is it because the role of climate change here is less certain? Or is this maybe just not an event that has the attention of the researchers who do that kind of work?
This is a very interesting question and involves quite a lot of research. You know, I was involved in writing a study about Hurricane Harvey and its consequences. And there, the overall estimates were that the climate change increased the rainfall probably by about 30% overall. And so there's a number of factors that come into play there, which include not just the original amount of extra moisture that's in the atmosphere, but the fact that the storm gets more intense and longer lasting and bigger. All of those factors come into play as a part of the climate change, and it's quite hard to sort those things out.
I mean, I hear you, though, saying it's worth waiting to get the answer right before we speculate too much about how much of an influence climate change has had on this particular event. And yet, right now is when public attention is focused on this. You know, 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, when that study has been done and published, the event is kind of past. And I wonder, I feel like the media coverage, the climate change angle, if you will, on this story hasn't been terribly prevalent with the flooding in the Midwest this time around. Do you feel like the story is being told adequately and that the public is getting the right message about the role of climate change in this particular event?
I mean, I think you're exactly right. And so there is the opportunity now, but getting it right, most scientists tend to be quite conservative in this respect and want to make sure they get it right. And the real problem here, of course, is that we're taking a phenomenon which is, you might say, is natural variability or natural weather, and then enhancing it in various ways. And so what happens is that we cross thresholds. We go beyond the experience that we've previously had, and a lot of things that have been designed in terms of water management and drainage systems and levees and so on were not designed to cope with that, and therefore things break. You know, this is what scientists refer to as nonlinearity. It's something which is very difficult to deal with. And so instead of $1 billion in damage, suddenly you've got $10 billion, or in the case of Harvey, $100 billion worth of damage. And it's what I call as the straw that breaks the camel's back syndrome. So you add a little, you know, the climate change component, maybe the original extra is 10%, but in terms of the damage, you can easily get 100% or more because of the way in which these factors play into one another. And that's something which is very difficult to assess, and it's one which I think economists in general underestimate.
That's Kevin Trenberth of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Thanks so much.
You're most welcome.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. This isn't the first time the Mississippi River has flooded, of course. Massive flooding in 1993 dumped so much water into the Gulf of Mexico that it formed a freshwater blob that oceanographers could track as it moved out into the Gulf Stream. That sparked an perhaps obvious but important idea for oceanographer Ray Schmidt. Whenever it rains, that water has probably evaporated from somewhere in the ocean, and it has left behind salt. Schmidt figured that if he could find the patches of extra high salinity in the ocean and understand where winds and air currents were carrying that water, he could predict rainfall more accurately and further in advance of current forecasts. It's an idea he and his colleagues have worked on for several years, often facing skepticism and lack of funding. But Schmidt, working with his twin sons, has now proven the idea can work. They're the winners of a year-long competition run by the Bureau of Reclamation to see who could come up with the best method for forecasting precipitation, not just a few days in advance, but 3 to 6 weeks out. Ray Schmidt is a scientist emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. His twin sons are Stephen Schmidt, a software developer at Network Appliances in Waltham, and Eric Schmidt, a mechanical engineer at Verist Engineering in Needham. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Heather. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Ray, 3 to 6 weeks out. This is kind of in forecasting like a no man's land, right? We've got our 3-day and 10-day forecasts that we all get on our phones or TV or whatever. And then NOAA, the National Weather Service, tends to put out these seasonal outlooks. It's going to be a cold, snowy winter. It's going to be a really active hurricane season. But there's these kind of broad things. And then you've got this in between of like 1 month out, no idea what's going to happen. What makes that time range so difficult?
Yeah, that's sort of an area of new interest. They call it sub-seasonal, that gap, as you said, 3 weeks to 3 to 6 weeks. I decided to try something different. We looked at a patch of land and looked globally for all the sea surface temperature and sea surface salinity predictors that might help forecast.
So let's dig into that. How does a change in the salinity of a certain patch of ocean predict rainfall over some piece of land weeks or months later?
Yeah, well, salinity is an indicator of how much water the ocean has exported from that region.
So how much has evaporated into the atmosphere?
How much has evaporated? The climate system, evaporation in particular, is a complicated function of the sea surface temperature, the humidity of the air, the wind speed, and you know, lots of complicating factors that we can't really measure. But salinity is telling you how much actually left the area. You know, some of it's going to rain back locally, but you can take, say, a 1 degree patch of ocean and look at the changes in its sea surface salinity over time. And we see some years it's saltier than other years. And so those times are when it's exporting more water from that region.
The interesting thing is that when we think about rainfall in the American Southwest, the major predictor that tends to be used is El Nino. And yet, by finding these patches of changes in salinity in the ocean, you are actually able to predict even better. So obviously, you've got an idea that when this contest comes up in 2016, hey, we've got an idea that could really win this contest that could be a better predictor than what's out there. But you've, you know, had these various scientists coming through your lab working on it. And no offense to Eric and Stephen, I know you guys are still there. Why choose to enter this contest with your sons as opposed to some of those scientists who had been working on this problem with you?
Yes, well, we did this sort of global thing looking for correlations. And it turned out we could predict an amazing amount of the winter precipitation in the Southwest. 70% of the variations.
Wow.
And we went to a big meeting and presented our results in a poster. And in parallel sessions, the people who look at El Nino were scratching their heads about why their predictions failed. And we could show that we could explain 70% of the variations in rainfall. And El Nino only explained 14% of the variations in rainfall. So I told them to go look at our poster, and we won a Best Student Poster Award. But anyway, a little later in December, on December 23rd, I got an email from a colleague talking about this rainfall forecast contest. And I said, oh, how am I going to – I got to enter this. But I don't have any team because they had all left, and you know, I don't have the computer skills to do all that stuff. And so 2 days later at Christmas, I see the boys and I say, "What's up, guys?" And they tell me they've been using artificial intelligence to play computer games. And I said, "How'd you like to enter a real competition with real prize money?" Because they were offering $100,000 in the precipitation, each of these two precipitation categories, 3 to 4 week lead and 5 to 6 week lead. Now, it was a lot of work. Every 2 weeks, we had to generate forecasts at each of those two leads. And so I spent a couple of months twisting their arms. And perhaps they want to comment.
So, Eric, you are a mechanical engineer, and Stephen, you're a software developer. Obviously, as your dad has mentioned, you have the skills to do this, but you've got jobs, you've got lives. What finally convinced you, and for that matter, not all twin brothers, once they're off leading their own lives, want to commit to months of working together. So what talked you guys into it? What convinced you to get into this contest?
You know, I think it was a bit of curiosity, a bit of wanting to please my dad, and a bit of a potential for reward money.
Never underestimate the power of a reward. I mean, you guys have now won in two of the categories, correct? What are you planning to do with that prize money?
Well, I did just purchase a house, so that is probably where most of it just went.
And Stephen, how about you?
Yeah, well, I just got engaged, so I imagine there'll be some expenses in my future as well.
Fabulous. I mean, as Ray, your father, has mentioned, this was a huge time commitment to produce these forecasts every 2 weeks for an entire year. And to win, I mean, you guys took the lead really right away. How surprised were you?
Yeah, I mean, we were blown away. We didn't have any expectations going into it because we just didn't know how our model would compare to anyone else's. And we suspected that some advanced teams would be entering, people who did this for a living. And here we are with no real climate or weather experience and just trying something out kind of on a whim. And it really got exciting once we started seeing what scores we were getting.
And we should say, I mean, you were being scored against the best existing forecasting methods, right? And the goal was that you had to do better.
We had to
than
beat
that.
Them. Yeah, we had to beat them.
After, Ray, as you've said, years of working on this, facing skepticism, a lack of funding, not being able to get funding to continue this research because of that, was there a sense of vindication when these scores were coming in?
Oh, yeah. So actually, the story of the first score, so we submitted our first forecast in April of 17. Stephen got him in. There were some test forecasts. And so I didn't have any confidence that the boys were taking it seriously. And then so the first forecast go in April. A month later, I'm running a big meeting about ocean salinity at Woods Hole. And I have 100 people in the room. And of the morning, you know, I'm running this conference. I have to introduce speakers. I get an email from the bureau saying the first scores are in. So I just forward it to Stephen. And then I come back at lunchtime to check my email. And Stephen said, "Hey, Dad, check it out. We're ahead by a lot." Our first forecast was great. And basically, we led the whole way. And the forecast organizers were very impressed with our long lead forecast. Most people's forecast got worse at longer lead. Ours stays strong. And at the end, our forecast score was twice as good as the nearest competitor, and they were a professional forecast company.
So, Stephen, does Salient, that's your team name for this competition, does Salient continue? Is there a future for this forecasting?
Well, so there might be. At the moment, we're kind of exploring, you know, if there's commercial opportunities for this type of forecast.
There's also a potential another competition coming up that the Bureau announced would start this summer. So we'll see about that.
I'm curious, in doing this competition, Eric, you mentioned that it feels good to have made a contribution. I mean, you guys have potentially pushed the boundary and the standard for what forecasting can do in terms of precipitation forecasts. In addition to feeling good, is there any kind of downside to that of questioning the strength or the quality of our forecasts? Does it cause you to call into question kind of the establishment when you can come into this without that oceanography background and blow all the professionals out of the water?
The purpose of the competition was aimed at using machine learning to predict weather better. And I think some of the teams perhaps all of the teams did that. We really wanted to use an AI approach, and so we looked into deep learning. And I'm not sure if that's what pulled us ahead of the others, but it could be. And I don't know what the others did for strategies.
So some of the methods we used are really the state-of-the-art, cutting-edge AI techniques. That's kind of the role that Eric took. Eric was more the AI ML person, and I took on the task of gathering the data and automating the whole process. But Eric was reading the latest papers on AI techniques, and I don't think it's discouraging so much as encouraging of what the future might hold with the latest technology that's being developed.
That's Stephen Schmidt, a software developer at Network Appliances in Waltham. His twin brother, Eric Schmidt, is a mechanical engineer at Verist Engineering in Needham. And their father, Ray Schmidt, is a scientist emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Together, they are Team Salient, one of the winners of a recent rainfall prediction contest run by the Bureau of Reclamation. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
You can find Team Salient's forecast for the next 10 weeks at salientpredictions.com. Up next, this year's winner of the Templeton Prize is an astrophysicist who says science is spiritual. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Templeton Prize was established in 1972 by the late Sir John Templeton to honor, quote, a living person who has made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. Past recipients include Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama, but also a substantial list of physicists and cosmologists. This year's winner falls into that latter category. Marcelo Gleiser is a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College and this year's Templeton Prize winner. Congratulations and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
You found out about this, I understand, on your 60th birthday. What a birthday present indeed.
Yes. Well, no. So the story is even more torturous than that. So it's I found out December 21st, and I had to keep a press embargo for 3 months, knowing it was going to be announced on my birthday, on my 60th birthday. So it's really quite something.
That's quite a secret to keep for that long.
It was. It was indeed. But I'm very relieved now that it's out in the world.
And this is a substantial prize, $1.4 million. What are you planning to do with that money?
So 37% goes into taxes. It's always good to remember. But the rest of it, I'm going to break into three parts. I have lots of kids, children, and some of them still have to go through college. And so some of it will go to help me with that. Some of it will go to help me with retirement. And some of it I'll be giving to some charities that I care about.
Now, you are not the first physicist to receive this prize, but you are the first Latin American. You came to the U.S. from Brazil. How special is this for you on that front?
Oh, it's super special. It's a wonderful thing. It, you know, I don't think there has been any Latin American that has received this prize yet in 49 years. So I know already, just from the response that I've had so far, that the impact is being huge there because, well, yes, we have people that are worried and questions about scientific advance and science and spirituality. And furthermore, you know, there is the other part of the story is that I am an immigrant here in the United States. And so it also plays very well, I think, with what's going on right now in terms of the importance of immigrants in the culture of this country.
How and when did you first get interested in science or maybe physics specifically?
When I was about 13, 14. It turns out that I'm Jewish by upbringing. And so for my bar mitzvah, which is a celebration when you turn 13, I got this gift, which was an autographed photograph of Einstein. So Einstein came to Brazil in 1925, and I had a relative, long-distance relative, that was his host when he was in Rio. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. So that photograph has remained in the family for decades until I got it when I was 13, and of course I got it because I was already thinking about it, and I had a fascination with the universe and with the big questions. And once I got it, I actually read a couple of popular books by Einstein, his autobiographical notes, and a book called The Evolution of Physics. And I really fell in love, not just with the physics he was talking about, but with the way he engaged science as a bigger questioning of humanity. You know, science is not just about technological progress, you know, the better GPS or the faster chip for your iPhone, but it's really something that engages us with questions that go way beyond the existence of science, you know, questions of meaning, questions of origins. And I thought that was fascinating. And from then on, you know, that was sort of my path.
Marcelo Gleiser, your work at Dartmouth College as an astrophysicist, a cosmologist, I mean, you clearly followed that passion to ask big questions, and you describe your research as exploring what happens at the intersection of the very, very large and the very, very small. And you're interested in questions of how complexity arises in our universe. What are some of the research questions that you're really trying to answer?
Right. So this intersection of the very large and the very small, which is something funny, we say, how do the two possibly intersect? Well, it has to do with the expansion of the universe. So when you look out into very faraway galaxies, you realize that they are moving away from one another, and that is what we call the expansion of the universe. And so when you are trying to map the locations and the velocities of these galaxies, you are interested in the very large, right? However, the fact that the universe is expanding means that if you play this movie backwards, what you're going to see is that matter becomes more and more concentrated in a smaller volume as you go backwards in time. And in fact, as you get very, very close to the beginning of time, you reach incredibly high temperatures and densities. And when that happens, matter, as we know, it breaks down into its smallest constituents, what we called the elementary particles, like electrons and the quarks that make up the protons in the atoms. And so from a particle physics perspective, the physics of the very small, the early universe, the young universe, was kind of like a cosmic soup of elementary particles. So you have the very small at the beginning and you have the very large now. But if you want to reconstruct the whole history of the universe, which is what cosmologists like me try to do, you need to understand the connections. And so the very small determines in many ways what the very large is going to become. In cosmology, we look out into the universe for fossils of the very, very far away time in the past so that we can tell this story for everyone. Because that story, the story of the universe, is in a very real sense our story too.
Is that a story that you think we will ever be able to tell definitively from a scientific perspective? I mean, there must be limits to what we can possibly know about what happened before our universe, or if there is an outside our universe, what happens there?
Oh, that's an awesome question. Thanks for asking it. So, absolutely, we will not be able to tell this whole story, in my opinion, ever, unless science becomes something completely different from what it is now. And the reason is exactly what you said, that there are indeed limits to how much we can know of nature. You know, I mean, everything that we know of nature is being captured by instruments. I mean, the eyes and the ears can only see and hear so far, right? So we need instruments that amplify our vision of the world, right? I call them reality amplifiers, like microscopes for the small and particle accelerators for the very small. And then you have bigger and bigger telescopes for the very large. But every one of these instruments, wonderful as they are and spectacular as the vision that they bring of reality is to us, they are still limited in their range. They cannot see everything. And so for that reason, you can't really have all the answers to your questions because you don't even know all the questions to ask.
Marcelo Gleiser, you've been honored with the Templeton Prize for your contributions to our spiritual progress, not just our intellectual progress, and our understanding of where humans sit in the universe. As you talk about the limits of what we can possibly know from a scientific perspective, where does religion factor into that? Where does God factor into your picture of the universe?
Right. So I would not call it God. And I would only call it religion in the most pure sense of the word, not in terms of organized religion, but in terms of a spiritual connection with something which is much bigger than we are. So when we are doing the kind of science that I do, you know, we are asking these very deep existential questions about the origin of the universe, the origin of matter, the origin of the sun and the planets, the origin of life. These questions are questions which are much older than science itself, right? They have been asked for thousands of years in philosophy and in many, many different kinds of religions across the world. And so science now is part of this tripod of human questioning. Always the same question. Where do we come from? How come the world exists? But with very, very different kinds of answers. But if you look into what science is actually doing and the way it works, science is all about exploring the unknown, right? I mean, when you say this fellow made a discovery, that means that now we know something we didn't know before. There was a part of the world that was unknown to us that now has been revealed to us through science and through research. So in a sense, science is really a flirt with the unknown. And because of that, it connects us with the mysterious dimension, with the dimension which I would call the mystery of who we are. So once science reaches into these sorts of existential questionings, right, it is serving to amplify our spiritual connection with the world and with the universe.
Marcelo Gleiser, you are a physicist. That's the path that you chose. Mm-hmm. You said you see it as a very spiritual endeavor and that you think that science and religion are often trying to get at some of the same questions from different angles, clearly leaving open a compatibility, I guess, that there can be both science and religion. Do you see the need for both science and religion in the human endeavor to understand our world and our place in it?
That's a very, very good question. And honestly, I couldn't speak for all of humanity. You know, that would be very presumptuous of me. But I could speak for many, many, many people who would say that absolutely, you know, there is no reason why there shouldn't be room for both. You know, I think that the way I look at science and the way I look at religion, as long as they both respect their limitations and do not try to step too much into the territory of the other. So, for example, scientists making blank statements about understanding questions that we don't, like the origin of the universe, that we really don't understand yet, or religious people trying to interfere in the science school curricula, you know, based on their faith, which I think is a disaster as well. So as long as we keep these boundaries very, very clear, I would say that there is no reason why you can't have both.
And yet many people do still view science and religion as incompatible on some level. I wonder what you think would be different if more people saw and understood science to be a spiritual endeavor rather than perhaps, simply something much more, I don't know, inhuman maybe.
Yeah, material and pragmatic. And well, I think the world would be a much better place because I think a lot of the arrogance of certain sciences would be kind of tamed, so to speak. Because if there is one thing that I have learned, you know, being a physicist for, 35 years or so, is that we are profoundly ignorant of what's going on. We know so much. Yes, of course we do. But we also don't know so much. And so to be arrogant about all the things we know is essentially, as my grandfather used to say, you know, to wear a hat bigger than your head, it basically covers your eyes. So once people understand this dimension of science, which is a much more, how can I say, humane dimension of science, I think a conversation between science and faith becomes much more constructive and less divisive.
Marcelo Gleiser is a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College and this year's Templeton Prize winner. Marcelo, happy birthday, congratulations, and
thanks so much
for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.